Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 597, interview with Ed Haslam about Dr. Mary's Monkey. This has been recorded on May 13th of the year 2007. It is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Ed Haslam, the author of, first of all, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, and now a companion supplemental volume, Dr. Mary's Monkey. Ed, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you, Dave.
Back in June of 1996, you and I undertook a three-hour piece of set-piece break-in radio battle, to coin a term, and we set forth, and I think, if I do say so myself, Ed, I think we did a pretty good job of laying out in a three-hour interview divided into half-hour segments your remarkable book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. That book came out in the mid-90s. It has a couple of different editions, and now you've come out with another book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, published by Trine Day Press. And this book not only recaps much of the information in your first book, but goes a whole lot further and ties that information in not only in a concrete way with the assassination of President Kennedy, but with some events that have overtaken all of us, a cancer epidemic, a soft tissue cancer epidemic, and AIDS, and a whole lot of other things. Ed, how would you think one would go about discussing your new book on top of all the information that we talked about in your old book? Where do you think would be a good starting point?
Well, I would say, you know, sort of, why did I do a new book at this point in time?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a handful of reasons. The first is, what Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus did was tell a story about an underground medical laboratory in New Orleans. And it was admittedly in the first draft didn't have all of the support that it needed to have to be a real hard accusation, but it was trying to sketch out, and that's why we spent 3 hours explaining it, trying to sketch out a landscape so that people understood the context in New Orleans, which was New Orleans at the height of the Cold War, was very involved in the Cuba thing. There was a very real fear that Castro was going to start World War III and New Orleans was going to get nuked. There was a real effort to get rid of Castro in there. I mean, that is the environment in which this this soup is brewed. But what I didn't have at the time was I didn't have a witness. So one of the things I have today that I did not have then was a real live witness who was inside of this operation and names names and explains exactly what they were doing. The second point is today I have a publisher that I didn't have before, and being self-published, you just don't have access to the bookstore system. And so today I'm happy to say that Trine Day has stepped forward to publish it. And thirdly, in 1995, when I came out with this, I was talking about cancer-causing viruses. And that was a subject that, frankly, the mainstream media did not embrace, and the clinical medical scene was not particularly fond of embracing. And so I was sort of stuck on a scientific limb there. But today, in 2007, there's front page news all over the place about the HPV vaccine, which mm-hmm. is the human papillomavirus. And so they now have a vaccine against a cancer-causing virus that causes cervical cancer. Therefore, it's virtually impossible for them to claim that there are no cancer-causing viruses.
Ed, let me jump in real quickly. As we're speaking on May 13th of 07, a couple of articles in the news in the last several months. First of all, the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, has been dragging his feet against a court order, I believe it was, to begin inoculating school children in Texas against that virus. And also just this past week, as fate would have it, there was a story that hit many of the internet wire or news features about oral sex possibly leading to throat cancer because of that very same virus that you alluded to, HPV. Is that the human papillomavirus? Am I
yes.
abbreviating
yes.
it correctly? But the virus you spoke about and are speaking about in your book is a whole lot worse than that.
Yes, but the point is the media can no longer say that cancers cannot be caused by viruses.
Yeah.
And that is a different terrain issue for today. And the final terrain issue is in 1995, the internet was a fledgling operation, and today it's very full bore, and there's the opportunity to get the word out and distribute books and everything else via the internet that wasn't there today. So it's a very empowering situation for somebody that has a story that needs to essentially end run the mass media.
It is indeed. And Ed, let me, as long as we're talking about the internet, before we launch into the substance of our on-air investigation here, FTR Program 19 is the program that I alluded to earlier. It's a three-hour discussion between myself and Ed Haslam. It is in half-hour segments, and it lays out in a pretty good form, I think, in pretty good detail, the substance of Ed's first book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. There are also supplemental interviews. Those are all available for free online. You can also order them for a very small price from Spitfire. I don't get any money from that, but if you go to www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, then scroll down to the archives page. You can also get that from Spitfire. That interview and some supplemental interviews where Ed found the linear accelerator that he'd been hypothesizing about, those interviews are available, and I strongly recommend that people who are serious about the line of inquiry that Ed is undertaking here get those interviews, listen to them, download them for free, send them to other people, and then you'll be grounded, I think, to undertake the new and improved version of Ed's book, which I think carries the whole, not only the research into cancer-causing viruses, but also research into the Kennedy assassination and its implications for today to a whole new level.
And while we're sort of doing this introduction, I want to address, you know, really who would be of interest in terms of listening to this this stuff. I think there are three real questions that come up there. First of all, anyone who had the polio vaccine during the 1950s, you really need to know what was in that, because there were dozens of monkey viruses, some of which very credible science now has established were cancer-causing. Secondly, if you've lost anybody to cancer, friends and family, and that's about 1 out of 10 people in the population in the United States would be consumed by that, and you're wondering why this is happening more today than it used to in the past, this provides some answers on that. And thirdly, if want to get a straight scoop on or a better understanding of where AIDS came from, this will help you understand that. And finally, if you never bought the fairy tale about the JFK assassination and you have always felt there's something else underneath it, this will really clean off the windshield on that particular point.
Yes, indeed. One very quick interjection, Ed. The virus in question, the SV40 virus, is, as far as we can tell, sexually communicated. So it isn't just people who got the original vaccine, but someone who may have had unprotected sex with someone who had the original vaccine. And that's a lot of people.
Yeah, and you can go one or several steps beyond that, because if it's passed around, it's passed around.
Yep.
But the question in terms of part of what we're doing here is we're trying to end run the mainstream media, and there's a reason for that. If you talk about AIDS, for example, the mainstream scientific community, not the conspiracy theorist or anybody else, but the mainstream scientific community says AIDS is caused by a mutation of a monkey virus, and that mutation occurred around 1960 or so. And therefore, the logical question is, who was mutating monkey viruses around 1960? I mean, that's the logical question, and it's never really been asked in the press or by any government agency or anything else that I've heard of. And what this book presents is a group of people who are politically motivated, who are developing a biological weapon, and were using radiation to mutate monkey viruses in the early 1960s. Now, that's an awfully serious situation as far as I'm concerned. And the reason I'm still at this 12 years into the process is that I think it's just now that we're starting to get enough light and evidence together, particularly with the new witness that I'll be talking about here in a little bit, to realize that this story is real and does have witnesses, and we need to understand what was going on and why. And the key to this whole thing is the murder of Dr. Mary Sherman, because when you analyze her murder in this situation, you realize that she's connected to all these people and that there was a really serious cover-up in her murder. And that is the key to understanding this whole puzzle.
Yeah, Dr. Mary Sherman, tell us briefly about who Dr. Mary Sherman was, Ed. And in so doing, if in a way I could ask the impossible, if you could tie that in with the research by people like Sarah Stewart and Bernice Eddy into the SV40 in the human papilloma, and then also key Mary Sherman into people like Dr. Alden Oxner, Tulane, the community of research into tropical diseases that grew up in New Orleans as a result, and then maybe we'll have the table set to where we can begin talking about David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald and Judith Very, who brings the story to a whole new level.
Well, first of all, that's a really tall order for
I know. We spent 3 hours doing it last time.
That's right. And I wrote a book in order to try to explain it. But
okay.
I will try to give you some top line issues. Mary Sherman was a medical doctor. She was a nationally recognized, if not internationally recognized, expert on cancer. She had been trained in the medical uses of radiation at the University of Chicago Medical School, which we will remember, the University of Chicago is where Enrico Fermi did the first sustained nuclear reaction, et cetera. She was brought to New Orleans by a prestigious and successful doctor by the name of Dr. Alton Oshner, who has a list of credentials longer than your arm, and I have a chapter on him. He was chief of surgery at Tulane Medical School, which is one of the most important medical schools in America in terms of tackling things like tropical diseases. And they're the host institution of the Delta Regional Primate Laboratory, which is why these people seem to know a lot about monkeys and monkey viruses. And Oshner was also very involved in the trade community in New Orleans and was a avid anti-communist, and in fact started an organization to spread anti-communist propaganda all through Latin America, an organization called INCA, which was instrumental in the media coverage of Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, for years, nobody has really understood this media coverage, and they've never really understood the trip to Clinton and the mental hospital and all that other stuff, and there's been a lot of kind of well-intentioned but improper analysis on it. What is pretty clear to me now that we have a witness who was there and who knew the players involved is that these people were explicitly trying to develop a biological weapon for the purpose of assassinating Fidel Castro.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this media coverage and the portrayal of Oswald as a leftist and a pro-communist kind of person in the media in New Orleans, which was all owned by radical anti-communists, was not to set him up to be a patsy in the assassination. It was to make him a more convincing sympathizer so that he could bring the biological weapon into Cuba.
Ed, just very briefly, in this last side of FTR program 47, listeners, in the same database, the same archive, I should say, maintained by WFMU that has FTR 19, the long 3-hour interview and also the subsequent interviews I did with Ed, for the record 47, the last side, I believe it's side E, people can actually hear the WDSU interview on Conversation Carte Blanche between Ed Butler and Lee Harvey Oswald and people like Carlos Bringier. So that's one of the things that people can recoup from the archives for themselves.
Yes, and there's a lot of really interesting stuff in that particular interview, particularly Oswald himself raising the question of how did he get back in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And at one point actually saying, well, I was at all times under the protection of, and then he starts saying, he draws back what he was trying to say, was at all times under the protection of the United States government. But it's an interesting interview, and it's one of the things that should be understood in order to grasp the dramatis personae, so to speak, Ed, that you have been putting together on the stage down in New Orleans.
Let me talk about this Judith Very Baker.
Yes, indeed.
Who is the new witness. The first thing that people should understand is that we have Judith Very Baker's W-2 form from 1963, which is very good documentation that she worked at the Riley Coffee Company,
mm-hmm.
which is where Lee Oswald worked. So that's a very firm piece of information. We also find out that she started working at the Riley Coffee Company on the same day that Lee Oswald started working there, which is kind of interesting also, particularly since they both were referred to them by the same employment agency. They both worked there for about the same period of time. The day that Oswald was fired was the day they decided to put an ad in the newspaper to replace Judith, and she was terminated a week later. She was actually really doing work there, so they had to spend a couple of days to find a replacement for her. But that really shows that she was there and was within a likely proximity to Oswald in order to understand what was going on. She was also a beautiful young woman at the time, and it is when you start to figure out where she lived and the fact that she rode the bus to work with Oswald in the morning and at home in the evening and stuff, you realize that she was in a very good position to know what Oswald was doing and up to.
Very quickly, Ed, William Riley, who owned that company, his political character is not irrelevant to the story here. Very briefly, tell us about William Riley and what makes the fact that the alleged communist Lee Harvey Oswald and Judith Very Baker wound up working at this company was so interesting.
Well, William Riley imported and sold coffee, and therefore his business was based upon getting coffee out of Central America. And the Castro Revolution in Cuba threatened much of the economic relationships with Latin America, and the business community in New Orleans, where Riley was located, felt very threatened by this from a business point of view. And it became very active in an anti-communist crusade, which Alton Ochsner helped articulate in the form of the Information Council for the Americas, which was INCA that I mentioned a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Riley was one of the members of INCA and a major financial contributor to her. So we're talking very extreme anti-communist activities. Another person who was involved in that was the owner of WDSU-TV and a list of local politicians. And it wasn't just these handful of people. They had Ed Butler went around and recruited everybody he could to donate money to their anti-communist crusade. But this, the INCA group was very extreme right wing. And so Riley was part of that. But I don't know and can't say for sure at this time was whether the owners of Riley Coffee Company actually knew what was going on in their own company or not. That's I don't have any evidence to say that they did, but what we find there is a very suspicious set of circumstances where the person that had to approve Oswald's hiring and to whom Judith Very Baker actually reported was an ex-FBI agent. And one of the things that's very interesting is like John Davis wrote a book called Mafia Kingfish,
mm-hmm.
which blames Carlos Marcello for the murder of President Kennedy. And in the introduction to that, you discover that Davis got all of his information on Marcello and everything else from one of these faux government organizations in New Orleans called the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Well, it turns out that this man that Judith worked for and the guy that hired Oswald His name was Moynihan,
mm-hmm.
William Moynihan. Well, after he leaves Riley, Bill Moynihan becomes the executive director of the Metropolitan Crime Commission.
Mm-hmm. There was another former FBI agent in the New Orleans area who also figures prominently in the story. I don't know if this is just too much of a loose end to tie in here, but perhaps you might want to throw Guy Bannister's name in and tie him in with David Ferry and this whole milieu we're talking about.
Well, it's been known for a long time and is the subject in many books that Guy Bannister was connected to both Lee Oswald and David Ferry in New Orleans in the summer of 1963. What is interesting is that Judith, who is not some ordinary secretary, I'm going to talk about her background in a second, but in fact, let me say it now. Judith was a scientific whiz kid who started doing things with cancer when she was still in high school and using radiation. And we have documents, newspaper articles and the like, that show that she personally was trained by the top people in the country involved, who were medical people involved in handling cancer-causing viruses. And she has all this background and credentials before she goes to New Orleans. And she goes to New Orleans because she's invited to go there by Dr. Ochsner and to work for Dr. Mary Sherman in her lab at Ochsner's clinic. And she gets there and she winds up meeting Oswald and introduced to Ferry, and they start talking about all this wild stuff and killing Castro and all this stuff. And Judith starts getting spooked by the whole thing, and she turns to Lee Oswald and says, "You got to show me something that proves to me that this is really a government operation and not something that's off the wall." And Oswald takes her down to Guy Bannister's office and introduces her to Guy Bannister, who confirms that Oswald is working with them on a Get Castro project. But what gets really unclear in all of this is you start to figure out that Oswald is part of the New Orleans Mafia. I mean, he's born and bred into it.
Now, this is something, Ed, we did not talk about very much in our first interview. We've alluded to it a couple of times in interviews since. Perhaps we should develop this here, since the links between Oswald and the Marcello Syndicate are one of the things that occupies a fair amount of time in your book. Tell us about Ms. Murette and about Oswald's familial connection to La Familia.
Well, it's been mentioned in many JFK books for a long time that Oswald's uncle knew Carlos Marcello and was a chauffeur or something like that for him. What we learned from Judith, who goes around New Orleans with Oswald at his elbow throughout the summer, is that all these people who were in the mafia and had family members in the mafia all remember Lee from when he was a child, where he would show up at parties with his mother in this context of inside the mafia families. And more importantly than this, Carlos Marcello owned 13 restaurants and clubs in the French Quarter in New Orleans, one of which was the infamous 500 Club, which was a strip joint. But he also owned some restaurants and stuff. And Judith would go with Lee to these restaurants, and they would sit down and order whatever they want to. And then Lee would nod to the manager, and they'd walk out without paying the bill. I mean, they were eating free at Carlos Marcello's tables in the summer before 1963. So when you to call somebody who's operationally a member of the New Orleans Mafia a lone nut is really off base. But when you understand how powerful the mafia was in New Orleans in terms of its influence over the political organizations, then you realize that a lot of people didn't want to cross swords with Carlos Marcello. And it was a lot more convenient for everybody to say that he was a lone nut. But even people like Jack Ruby not only knew Oswald, but mm-hmm. they knew of Oswald's involvement in the biological weapon. So the whole point is, by framing Oswald, they created this situation where if that guy ever got into a courtroom and started talking about what he knew, lots of people were going to be in lots of trouble. I mean, mm-hmm. big time trouble. And I mean, just in as simple language as I can put it, they had to kill him to shut him up to protect this biological weapon operation in New Orleans. And when you start to see the pieces, and this is kind of a complicated thing to explain, the radio thing, but again, that's why I wrote a book to carefully lay out the pieces and the evidence so that you can see the trail. Then you start to see how the whole thing fits together. And if the book has a contribution to make to these discussions, it is that it, kind of like the unified field theory, it pulls all these
connections. Then there is, in point of fact, a free lunch. And Lee Harvey Oswald had some very, very interesting connections. He didn't. One of the few things Lee Harvey Oswald didn't do was kill Kennedy. He was involved in an awful lot of other things, and he was not a nut, and he definitely wasn't alone. He was an individual with connections which, if they went in any one of a number of different directions out from Lee Harvey Oswald, would have led to the corridors of power, political power, economic power, and medical power, too.
Yes. One of the things that about Judith is that Judith was featured on a program on the History Channel, which appeared once and then was pulled by the History Channel, and that's sort of another story. But that episode is now on the internet, and you can find it at my website. And if it's okay with you, may I tell people where they can find it?
Yes, definitely, because we're almost at the break point, the half-hour break point of the broadcast, so that's a perfect segue. Go ahead, Ed,
okay,
please do.
It is called The Monkey Virus. That's themonkeyvirus.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there you'll find a video interview with me and this whole episode with the interview with Judith Berry Baker and other information there, links into related websites which talk about, you know, AIDS and JFK and SV40.
All righty. And also, www.spitfirelist.com and the many, many linked websites, including the WFMU website, which features, among other things, the original three-hour interview about Mary Ferry and the monkey virus that Ed and I did back in June of 96, and subsequent interviews as well. Again, that's themonkeyvirus.com, correct, Ed?
Yes.
All righty, and that is Ed's website. You can order the book there, can you not?
Yes, you can.
How about your first book, Ed? Is that still available?
No. Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus is forever going to be the underground roll-up to Dr. Mary's Monkey.
Oh, okay.
Because all the substantive stuff from the first book is in the second book, but there's more in the second book.
Understood. And listeners can avail themselves of For the Record 19 to get a three-hour intense prep on the landscape that we have been visiting so far and that we're going to explore at greater length inside, too. We've been visiting with Ed Haslam, the author of first Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, and now the recently released and currently available Dr. Mary's Monkey, published by Trine Day Press. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 597, interview with Ed Haslam about Dr. Mary's Monkey. For Ed Haslam, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening. This is being recorded on May 13th of the year 2007. Happy Mother's Day.